This is an I Am Listening original podcast.
In Tunbridge Wells, the Borough Council owns the shopping centre, the Royal Victoria Place, it owns the town hall. There are these sort of major assets that really we need to keep hold of as a town, as an area. And if suddenly the ownership of those is passed to some West Kent unitary, that means that we're losing power, which is the opposite, if you like, of what devolution is meant to be about.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast, your go-to source for insightful discussions on local and national political matters. Join us as we take a deep dive into local government across the county. Find out what the key decision makers have to say, what your money is being spent on, and how the party's policies could affect how we live. Plus, don't miss our regular feature, Westminster Watch, where we dissect the latest developments and decisions shaping the political landscape in the heart of the UK's capital. Engage with us as we delve into the issues that matter to you and explore the dynamic world of politics from a Kent perspective.
Welcome to the first Kent Politics podcast of 2025. So happy new year to you all. And what a year it's going to be for local government in Kent. Angela Rayner's devolution revolution is effectively underway. And that means the county could have its own mayor by May 2026 and three massive new super councils shortly thereafter. But it's January and it's council business as usual, and it's the week that Medway finds how much or little of its cash it's going to get from the government. A famous local artist fell foul of planning regs over a piece of yellow paper, and Kent's taxpayers could end up paying the multi-million pound bill for delays to a major improvement scheme on Bluebell Hill. My name is Simon Finlay, local democracy reporter covering Kent County Council, and with me is Robert Boddy, who's been looking after Medway Council this week.
Hello.
And Dan Essen, who covers the district and borough councils in Kent.
Hello. Happy New Year.
Also joining is KM Media Group senior news editor Nikki White.
Hello.
First up, Robert, what's been happening in your day job at Medway?
Well, it's coming up to when all councils have to balance their budgets, and a major piece has been shifted into place. This is the provisional government settlement, basically a draft version of the amount of money through various grants and funding which Medway Council will receive. Although it's called the provisional settlement, it's usually pretty close to how the final version will turn out.
And what does it tell us?
So in raw numbers, Medway's core spending power is to increase by £18 million up to £282.5 million. This is a rise of 6.8%, which is above the average increase for councils across the country, which is 6%. And that's because the government said it intended to target additional funding to areas with high levels of deprivation.
So what does that mean for the other financial problems the council is facing?
The council's latest report, which outlines in detail Ofsted's understandings and findings in response to the provisional settlement, says the funding increase is not enough to plug the anticipated £26.5 million shortfall, which is predicted for next financial year, and the council will still need to ask for exceptional financial support from the government for a second year.
So what have you been looking at then, Dan?
I went to my first planning committee of the year over in Folkestone this week, where local artist Sam Cox, aka Mr. Doodle, got a healthy dose of bureaucratic headache. He was looking for permission to demolish and rebuild a home on Dungeness Beach, surrounding it with a metal cladding laser cut into his distinctive doodle art style. It looked like it was going to get approved, but councillors were told that the council had neglected to put up all of the regulation yellow posters, which you're meant to when a planning application comes in, despite the fact all the neighbours are well aware of it. This means technically they didn't do the right consultation. So for the sake of following process to the letter, it's been deferred and probably won't be decided for at least another month.
What's been across your radar since you got back from your travel, Simon?
Well, there's been a major debate going on this week over the devolution plans for Kent and the breakup of the current system of local government. We will return to this, I'm sure, ad nauseum over the weeks and months and probably years to come. But suffice it to say, the leader of Kent County Council will be submitting his proposal to the government, literally, as we speak. And we'll update you in the next week's show about where we think this is all likely to go. But one story that did crop up this week, which kind of summed up the disconnect between local government and central government, and guess what? It's going to cost the taxpayer in Kent many, many millions of pounds.
How so?
Well, Kent County Council has been trying to advance improvement to the traffic situation on the A229 on Bluebell Hill. And anyone who's been up there at rush hour will know exactly what we're talking about, particularly between Maidstone and Medway. And they've been trying to get this underway for about 5 years. This will involve traffic measures to widen roundabouts, create slip roads, and other significant schemes of work to get the traffic moving and keeping it moving. The Department of Transport, which has given it the go-ahead about a couple of years ago, but since then, their there have been nothing but delays in getting the finances sorted out.
What's the consequence of this?
Well, the project is in the KCC budget for 200 million quid, which was the original amount they thought it was going to cost. But because of the delays and the rise in prices and other inflationary pressures, particularly since the war in Ukraine, that figure has now risen to £250 million. That's £48 million more than the original figure. That's right, you heard of it was £250 million, not £200 million. So local KCC member Sir Paul Carter, who's not a man to mince his words at the best of times, has made his views very clear on the subject, and he says it typifies what he called the malaise of the public sector and the fact that you can't get anything done. It's online and well worth having a read. Nikki, what's been happening at Westminster?
Well, there's a number of trusts outside Kent declared critical incidents this week due to exceptionally high demand at A&E. It will come as no surprise that the subject has been on the agenda of many of our MPs in Kent this week. It's understood that there were a dozen hospitals in England who declared major incidents at one point on Tuesday, with bosses warning that rising numbers of flu cases and other respiratory illnesses have just left them extremely busy and under immense pressure. It's that time of year when the NHS is under particular strain. That's nothing unusual, but it's obviously an opportunity to highlight some of the issues that need tackling.
So what have our MPs had to say?
So East Thanet MP Polly Billington, she's raised concerns in Parliament about plans for a new NHS Thanet integrated hub. She actually supports the scheme, but she's worried that there's objections that are going on, which could derail the progress of that community health resource. The proposal itself is we'll see a disused university building at Westwood Cross in Broadstairs transformed into an all-in-one healthcare centre. And that is going to offer up to 60,000 same-day GP appointments a year, which for anyone who's tried to get an appointment on the day, you'll know that that's going to be, you know, absolutely vital. With the life expectancy in Thanet lower than the national average and local rates of conditions such as heart disease, cancer, chronic kidney disease, they're all much worse than the South East average in Thanet. She says she wants to see that hub open at the earliest opportunity. Ashford MP Sojan Joseph, who we know worked in the NHS, he also spoke in Parliament about NHS backlogs, and he raised the issues of delays in discharging people, so overcrowding and long waiting lists at the William Harvey Hospital. He also spoke about how reforms to social care will need to play their part in fixing our NHS. He said what we needed to do was focus more on community-based services rather than treating people in hospitals to help ease the burden. He was saying that we need to stop those backlogs that are being created by people being admitted to hospital, treated, but then have nowhere suitable to be discharged to. Then we had Sittingbourne and Sheppey's Kevin McKenna. He spoke about the new community diagnostic centre on the Isle of Sheppey. And then Tunbridge Wells MP Mike Martin, he sought reassurances from the minister that Kent will receive a paediatric long COVID service, which we don't have at the moment. And then lastly, Canterbury MP Rosie Duffield, she raised the issue of patients in East Kent who are continuing to face unacceptably long A&E delays. She told the House about a report that we actually carried on Kent Online last month, where conditions in East Kent Hospital Trust's hospitals were compared to a war zone. In 2024, an average of 40 patients a day were facing waits of more than 12 hours. She said she'd frequently raised this crisis at the East Kent Hospitals Trust with the government, and seven different health secretaries, she said, had promised much and delivered nothing at all. So she asked Health Secretary Wes Streeting to meet her and the Hospital Trust's chief exec, who she said was in desperate for the most basic diagnostic equipment to ensure that this doesn't continue to be the case for another 7 years. Mr Streeting said he'd be delighted to meet with her and discuss not only this issue, but some of the other challenges that the area is facing too.
Is there a topic that you would like to be discussed on the Kent Politics Podcast? Perhaps you've got a question for one of our panel, or you'd like to comment on a hot topic in local or national government. Get in touch by emailing or sending a voice note to kentpoliticspodcast@thekmgroup.co.uk.
Kent's only Liberal Democrat MP took a circuitous route to Parliament. From serving in the British Army in Afghanistan to a PhD in War Studies at King's College, Mike Martin was then elected as the MP for Tunbridge Wells last July, and he joins us now. Mike, how are you?
Hey, good morning. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. So I guess the first and obvious thing is, how's the first 6 months in the new job in Parliament?
It's great. I mean, the first 3 months is
a bit like drinking from a fire hose, because you've got all of this information coming at you and you're trying to get set up in Parliament and you're trying to recruit your team. But once you're out of that initial first 3 months, the next 3 months, you're really solidifying. And now, had a good break over Christmas. 2024 was a really, really busy year, and we're sort of really fresh and ready to... Well, we've already hit the ground running now. We're into the new year.
Yeah, the Liberal Democrats went from very, very few MPs to quite a lot. So what's it like getting to know all your new colleagues?
It's great. You know, right at the beginning, it was a bit like starting a new school, I suppose. But yeah, we're the largest third party in 100 years. We've got 72 MPs. And it's great because, you know, you campaign for 18 months on a manifesto and a set of policies and the things you want to do around GPs and social care and defence is a particular interest of mine you mentioned in the introduction. And then you get into Parliament, you've got loads of colleagues. And so you've got weight in Parliament and you can start to push those policies forward and make real change.
So it seems there's a sort of general consensus that the first half year or so of the new government hasn't gone particularly well for the Labour Party. What's your general assessment of how Keir Starmer and his team are holding up?
It's a really, really good question. And I've sort of been observing them in Parliament. It strikes me that they had a very good plan for winning the election, and they hadn't thought so much about what it was they were going to do once they got in power. And I think we've seen that. So on the economy, for instance, you know, the big thing is meant to be growing the economy. That's what we all agree on that we must do. And yet they've been talking down the economy. They did the winter fuel allowance separate from the budget. And then there was the budget with the NIC contributions, which has really got a stranglehold on business, and businesses are having to lay people off. It all feels just a little bit disjointed, like they didn't have a kind of cohesive plan. And obviously we had all of that stuff, it seems like a long time ago now, but listeners will probably remember they had this chief of staff called Sue Gray who had to be sacked, and you know, it's all just been a bit chaotic. So I guess for me, and we're doing this at the moment, opposition is about planning for government. What are you going to do in government? How are you going to make the country better? And it seemed to me like Labour were doing not that much of that in opposition, and they were focusing much more on just how to win the election.
One of the big policy issues, which is particularly resonant in Kent and that the government's made a really big deal out of, is housing reform, planning reform and housing targets specifically. You know, yeah. Tunbridge Wells Borough Council is facing the largest increase in its housing targets in all of Kent. You know, the new housing target is over 1,000 homes built per year. It's an increase of about two-thirds. I mean, what do you make of it and how it will affect Tunbridge Wells in particular?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I mean, the bottom line is, as a country, we need to build more houses, right? So that's the kind of my starting point. And I've got as many people in my inbox saying we can't get on the housing ladder. The rental market's too expensive. Obviously, the rental market is linked to the housing market. You know, can't get a social house. So the housing market's broken. So we do need to fix that. But you've rightly said that Tunbridge Wells has been projected to have this huge increase. And that was because of affordability, basically. That was the criteria on which they looked at it. And Tunbridge Wells is a very expensive place to buy a house. It's impossible to view the planning stuff without looking at devolution. And maybe we'll talk about this later, because these are the two big things the Labour government's done. And they're saying that Tunbridge Wells is going to have this massive increase in housing numbers. But actually, in 2 years' time, Tunbridge Wells Borough Council is not going to exist because it's being merged with Kent County Council. So what that means for housing numbers and where those houses go is really not clear. And the government hasn't given any clarity on how these two big agendas that they have, planning reform and devolution, how they work together.
Yeah, I was going to ask about devolution as well. But first, as a general principle, I mean, there's a lot of districts in Kent that, like Tunbridge Wells, that as far as the government are concerned, even as far as previous governments were concerned, have consistently failed to deliver on their housing targets. Places like Seven Oaks, Tunbridge Wells, Tunbridge and Morling, the quite rural, frankly, a lot more affluent and more expensive part of Kent, where they haven't built as many homes. You know, if places like Tunbridge Wells, Tunbridge, Seven Oaks are failing to deliver the amount of homes that they need, do you think it's legitimate that the government, you know, basically forces development on them as they are threatening to do to districts if they don't hit these new targets?
Well, I think there's a reason why it's more difficult to build houses in Tunbridge Wells in particular, because large swathes of the Tunbridge Wells constituency, and we're really lucky, but large swathes of the constituency are designated an area of outstanding natural beauty. And in the north of the constituency, we touch on the green belt around London. So what that does is that massively constrains the areas where you can build. And this is, again, I think this links to devolution, because it won't be Tunbridge Wells Borough Council that's given the housing targets anymore, because it won't exist. It will be the West Kent Unitary, which is kind of Seven Oaks, Tunbridge Wells, Maidstone, possibly Tunbridge, like they haven't quite worked out the area. That will be the local authority that's given the body to decide, you know, housing targets and how they push that through. And until we see exactly how that shakes out, it's really difficult to comment on this kind of specifics of sort of housing numbers and whether it's fair or just or whatever.
On the devolution local government reform, I think as we're recording this, we're expecting some more information from the county council later in the day. I mean, the argument of the government is basically full unitarisation of local government will make lines of responsibility and accountability simpler, and it'll be with mayoral authorities, whatever, it'll be easier to sort of coordinate regional economic policy. I mean, what do you think of the, I know they're pretty thin as it stands at the moment, what do you think of it, of the principle of local government reform? So if anyone was designing a local government system from scratch, surely you wouldn't design what we have now.
Yeah, the system that we have now has grown up over 1,000 years, and it just, you know, it's everywhere has a slightly different version of local government. So overall, I agree with the idea of devolving power, which is what this is about. And I agree with the idea of putting together county councils and district councils. So effectively removing a layer of government, because it does make it, you know, I'll give you an example. If you're trying to sort out climate change in Tunbridge Wells, or you know, the congestion and contributions to carbon in Tunbridge Wells, parking is held by Tunbridge Wells Borough Council and buses are held by the county council. So there's a great example of how you've suddenly got two layers of government really acting in the same space. So overall, I do agree with the direction of travel. Here's the rub, though. Different councils have got lots of different assets. Different councils have got different levels of debt. Tunbridge Wells Borough Council is debt-free. Kent County Council has £1 billion of debt. And different councils have got different levels of council tax. So we all need to equalise those. And there are some really thorny problems to work out exactly how you implement that. In Tunbridge Wells, the Borough Council owns the shopping centre, the Royal Victoria Place. It owns the town hall. There are these sort of major assets that really we need to keep hold of as a town, as an area. And if suddenly the ownership of those is passed to some West Kent unitary, that means that we're losing power, which is the opposite, if you like, of what devolution is meant to be about. So whilst I agree with the overall direction of travel, there are some really knotty questions to sort through about who controls what. And in Tunbridge Wells, it's absolutely right that we retain control of the shopping centre right in the centre of town so that we can develop our own town centre rather than that power being taken away from us.
And do you think there's a chance that much like the previous local government reform and the Local Government Act of 1972, that it'll be a bit of a hodgepodge, it will end up quite messy, and then over the proceeding, you know, over the next 50 years or so, there'll be all sorts of alterations and changes, and then we'll just be back in this place again where, you know, everyone wants to reform local government but never quite get it done. Do you think they'll succeed in what they say they're doing?
Look, I wasn't alive in 1972, so it's hard to say. I think that, look, in the UK, we tend to evolve our governance, right? We don't have revolutions and wipe the slate clean and then say, you know, this is the new republic like they do in France and it all looks like this and everything's going to look the same. So, you know, that's how we do things in the UK. I do hope that the government can keep it as clean as possible, you know, as standardized as possible. There's this idea that, and I think it's a powerful one, that you can get all the mayors in England, you know, 30 or something people in a room together with senior government ministers, and that enables them to drive through change at a local level. I think that's very powerful. The Lib Dems have been arguing for devolution of power from Westminster for about 150 years, and that has been the sort of slow, gradual progression. And, overall, I think that's a very, very good thing. But the devil's always in the details.
I understand that, yeah, since you've been very busy since you got into Parliament. You serve on the Defence and National Security Committee. So I wanted to talk about, and obviously you've got an academic interest in it as well. I wanted to talk about those issues. So broadly, how do you think the new government is doing when it stands on foreign affairs? Especially, you know, there's been a lot of controversy recently about the relinquishing our claim over the Chagos Islands and that sort of thing. How do you think the government's doing on the world stage?
Mm. Well, for me, you know, there's always a lot of noise in politics, and the art, I think, of politics is to really boil down to what the key issues are. And for me, the key issue at the moment is the defence of Europe and the problems that we have with Russia. And at the moment, the focal point of that is, of course, Ukraine. But there's a wider question around NATO. Does it have enough resources? Is the UK contributing enough resources to NATO for the defence of Europe? And then, of course, with the election of Trump, there's this question of, are the Americans still engaged in the defence of Europe? And that, for me, a lot, you know, obviously including homeland defence in the UK, and there are some kind of shocking gaps in the UK's homeland defence that we can go through if you like. But that for me is the key, that's the key issue facing the UK government. And I don't think that they haven't necessarily hit the ground running on it. They've launched a defence review, which sort of given them 6 months of breathing space, and that's going to report, that will report later on in the spring, maybe March or April or May. Was it necessary to spend 6 months doing a defence review? I mean, the gaps in the UK defences and what's happening in Europe are sort of happening in real time. And there is this question as well of resources for UK defence. So getting us up to spending 2.5% of GDP on defence and reversing some of those cuts. So the Lib Dems have been calling for a long time to increase the size of the army by 10,000. Which reverses, I mean, extraordinarily, the Conservatives cut the size of the army and continued that cut, kept that cut in place after the invasion of Ukraine, which is absolute madness. So there are some things that they could do quite quickly that they haven't done. So, you know, we're going to have to wait to see, I suppose, until the defence review comes out later on in a couple of months' time. But I felt they could have been a bit bolder and moved a bit faster with that.
Mm. As a brief aside, I mean, obviously, you served in the army as an officer. What do you think of national service?
I think that the idea of all 18-year-olds in the country going through a year where they do something similar together, and I accept that not everyone would want to serve in the military, so you have to have some sort of civil option where you do a sort of community type thing. I think that does have a place and certainly should be discussed. And the reason for that is because we live in a society that is increasingly atomized. Like the things that held us together 50 years ago have progressively been, you know, we had churches and communities and villages and all the rest of it, and that's progressively broken down as our society has changed. And that's, you know, just part of society's progress. But this has been sped up massively by the internet and social media. You know, we live much more atomized lives. And so as a political figure, as a leader, if you like, in the political space, I think it's really important that as a country, we think about what we share and how we can, you know, we all belong here. We all live on this island. And things like national or community service, or call it what you like, I think are really important because everyone goes through that same experience. Everyone's got a touch point that they can, you know, no matter who you meet, you'll know that they'll have done that thing as well. And I think that sort of stuff is really, really important. Would it generate sort of instant military capability? No, I don't think it would, because soldiering these days is pretty complex and you're not going to learn much in it. You know, in a year, you sort of get up to the point where you're starting to be useful and then you've sort of done your year's service. But what it does do is it creates a whole, it unifies society, and then everyone's got basic military and resilience skills. They can look after themselves. I mean, the Finns are really, really good at this. Everyone goes through it. Everyone's got a sense of belonging. They've got these basic skills. And that does give you a society that you can build on if you do end up in a war, which we might actually do in the next 10 years. The world situation is extremely worrying at the moment. And then you've got a foundation of belonging, togethership, basic skills, resilience that you can build on to build higher level military capability should you need it.
You think there's a significant risk and a risk worth considering of the UK being involved in a major armed conflict in the next 10 years, really?
Yeah, I think that's possible, yeah. I think that, well, so if, I mean, if you look at, you know, the defence of the UK is rooted in the defence of Europe, right? That's just a kind of geopolitical reality. And British foreign policy for 1,000 years has been tied to what's going on the continent. And we have a extremely aggressive Russian state at the moment. It's not clear what's going to happen with the Ukraine war, but if Trump does some kind of grubby little deal there that emboldens Russia, then we're going to have real problems, because Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, Poland, all these other countries that Russia speaks about incorporating within its sphere of influence, or certainly bits of those countries, we are pledged by treaty to defend those countries, right? They're all part of NATO. They all come under the collective security guarantee. More broadly than that, in the whole European periphery, in the Sahel, there's huge instability there. That's a key sort of migration route into Europe. Obviously, huge amounts of instability in the Middle East. I think Syria is going to become more unstable. The wider Middle East, the Balkans is very unstable. Greenland, the sea areas to the west of Ireland is effectively unpatrolled. It's sort of blank space. There's a lot of Russian and Chinese activity there. The periphery of Europe is extremely unstable at the moment. And our defences, the UK defences, are particularly weak. And the thing about war is, if you prepare for it and you have a strong military, you're less likely to fight it, because your opponents look at you and think, okay, actually, these guys are serious. Whereas at the moment, because we're relatively weak in military terms, opponents look at us like Russia and think, oh, yeah, we'll have a go at that. And that's exactly what happened in Ukraine. We failed to deter the last time they went into Ukraine in 2014. We failed to deter in Georgia when Russia invaded Georgia in 2008. And each time you fail to deter, your opponents are emboldened to have another go because they think you won't respond. And, you know, we're just continuing that. We need to get much stronger on our UK defence and our collective defence through NATO. Because it's only through that strength that you are able to deter wars. So I think it's an extremely worrying time.
But like you mentioned, I mean, so in the past week or so, you know, Donald Trump has been making some curious comments about the sovereignty of Denmark over Greenland, which is a NATO member. You know, Donald Trump's idea of what constitutes NATO collective security is obviously very, very different to what a lot of people in the UK would like to see.
Yeah.
I mean, if Donald Trump isn't that interested in upholding what generations of American presidents have seen as the purpose of NATO, do you not think maybe it's time for Britain to reconsider that as well? You know, do you think if there were threats to the territorial integrity of Latvia, Lithuania and Estonia, that it would be legitimate and right for, you know, Britain to commit soldiers to fighting it when, you know, the core backer of NATO, the USA, is clearly not that interested? I couldn't see Donald Trump sending Americans to defend, you know, Tallinn from invading Russians, whether we'd like it or not.
Yes, and that's exactly the problem. Why should our defence, and by our, I mean UK and wider European defence, be at the whims of voters in seven US swing states every 4 years? The one thing that Donald Trump says that's absolutely right is that the UK and other European allies need to pay more for their defence. They need to put more in the collective NATO kitty. And the reason we work together, you know, NATO is the most successful defensive military alliance ever in the existence of humanity, in the whole time that humans have been fighting for hundreds of thousands of years. And for us to go it alone is madness. Collectively, NATO can defeat Russia, can certainly face down China. I mean, we don't want to get into a conflict with China, but you get my point. We're much stronger collectively, whereas breaking up NATO, utter madness at this time.
So kind of related, you, in 2014, you resigned from the armed forces so that you could write your book about the war in Afghanistan more critically and with less oversight from the Ministry of Defence. Do you think, as many people said at the time, and even more people think now, that the war in Afghanistan was doomed from the start?
I think the way the war was framed set it up to fail. So after 9/11, we had this choice of whether to go into Afghanistan or not. And at that point, Afghanistan had been experiencing a civil war for about 20 years. So even in 2001, it had been at war for over 20 years internally. And we went in, and what we decided to do was set up a government that we would support. And that was how, we kicked out the Taliban, and then we set up a new government and we supported that government. And what that did was that created the remnants of the Taliban, then regrouped and came for that government that had Western backing. So what that did was it set up a binary, a black, white, you know, it's the government versus the Taliban thing. And that was unfortunately, that framing of the war was a war that probably we could never win. win, we could probably contain it, and we certainly could have avoided the terrible outcomes we had in 2021 where we withdrew. But it was the wrong framing. There was another option in the early days, and that was to put Afghanistan into some sort of UN trusteeship. And we've done this in other countries, like Bosnia did it, Cambodia did it. The idea being that you have a sort of UN administration, obviously with you know, a large number of Muslim troops, perhaps from Indonesia or somewhere like that. And what they would do is then work to train Afghans at the lowest levels. So you start at district, then you go to province, then you go to region. And gradually you'd lift off and allow each of those areas to administer themselves. And eventually you just sort of, the Afghanization of the system starts from the bottom up until eventually you've got the UN, and then they step off, the UN trusteeship steps off, and the Afghans then run their own country. And alongside that, you want to run a proper process of peace and reconciliation. Because of that 20 years of war that we'd already had by 2001, there were lots of instances of war crimes and revenge and vendettas and all the rest of it. A proper process there where there was some justice and accountability, and at least those crimes were heard and people agreed that they were heard and they were drawing a line under it and they were going to move on. But that process didn't happen. And instead we set up a government that, you know, and then it set up this government Taliban dynamic, you know, as Donald Rumsfeld said, you're either with us or against us. And for me, it was about not necessarily the fact of the intervention per se. It was much more about the way that it was framed and set up. And it was, I think that came from the way that America was thinking at that time, which was highly emotional. They'd just been attacked in 9/11. It was very much global war on terror, for us or against us. And that was the wrong framing for that conflict. And so in a sense, the way we framed it created the backlash. And there was another way that we could have gone about that early stage.
Do you think we should, you know, after everything that happened in 2021, do you think that other governments, specifically in the West, should basically grit their teeth and recognise the Taliban as the government of Afghanistan? Because like it or not, you know, they are in full control of the country. The rebellion led by members of the former government in the Panjshir province seems to be tiny. You know, they are the government of Afghanistan, and there are good reasons why the West needs to have diplomatic relations with, you know, whoever's governing Afghanistan, you know, even if we fought them for 20 years and manifestly failed.
I think that what we've seen the Taliban do to women in Afghanistan, just as one topic, I mean, the other topic is the relationships that the Taliban movement have with other terrorist organisations.
But we have many allies who have relationships with terrorist organisations, and many allies who don't respect the rights of women or human rights full stop, like in the Gulf.
I think not to the same degree as in Afghanistan, actually. I think you would be hard-pressed. You know, I challenge you to name a country that treats women the way that the Taliban treat women in Afghanistan. And I think for that reason alone, it precludes us from recognition.
But I mean, obviously, the argument a lot of people make is that, you know, there are lots of, you know, many Afghan people who came here legitimately as refugees under the Afghan relocation assistance policy, but also many people from Afghanistan who came here illegally, some of whom who've committed crimes in this country. And surely it's within the remit of a state to deport foreign criminals to their country of origin, but we don't recognise the government of that country, so we end up, you know, sort of stuck with it. Do you not think that's a good reason to have some kind of relationship with them?
Whether we deport or don't deport illegal immigrants to their country of origin is nothing to do with recognition. It's actually to do with whether the country of origin is deemed as safe. So if people are coming here and claiming asylum because their country is, you know, war-torn or they're persecuted or whatever, whether they go back or not is entirely to do with whether that country is safe and whether that person is going to be persecuted. I'll give you another example. You know, we're dealing with HTS at the moment in Syria, aren't we? I mean, we're talking to the Taliban now, right? It's not that we're not talking to them, we just don't recognise them. And you've seen lots of refugees heading back into Syria recently, haven't you? Even though very few countries have recognised the HTS movement in Syria.
I know, I get you. Lastly, and back to domestic politics and very quickly, what do you think the future holds for the Liberal Democrats? You know, it's quite a meteoric rise from, you know, coalition to then having, what, you know, less than 20 seats to now being, you know, a massive force in Parliament. Do you think Lib Dems are here to stay, or do you think there's a risk that your party might be squeezed back into its former position?
No, our aim is to become the official opposition at the next election. And we're clearly, the United Kingdom, the British people, we are clearly experiencing a once in a century political transition. The last one was at the beginning of the 1900s, where the Labour Party overtook the Liberal Party and became the second party at that time. I think what we're going to see towards the end of this parliament is the Liberal Democrats eclipsing the Conservative Party. Society is in a huge transition. And, you know, we spoke a little bit earlier about atomization, but really the internet and the globalization of the world and all of the chaos we see around us in the international sphere. And this is why I say, well, we might be heading for a war. Hopefully we can avoid that war. But war or no war, our society and other societies around the world are going through a huge transition. And that means that in democratic societies, the electorates are very volatile. They change their vote often. Everyone is on a journey, and we're doing our best to listen to people and to put forward solutions to the problems that we face, so that people think, actually, do you know what? It's the Conservatives and Labour, it's not working anymore. That framing of Labour versus capital that was so powerful in the 20th century, I don't think that's actually the right framing in the 21st century. This idea of a union movement where so few industries are unionised, I think really undercuts the Labour message. And I think it's quite telling that Labour have to pretend to be a party that they are not. They have to pretend to be something that they're not in order to get elected. And the Conservatives, I mean, I don't even need to sort of give you any detail on the kind of dire state that they're in at the moment. And so people are looking for fresh answers, and people are looking for different people and ideas to see them through this transition and to build this new consensus, this new society as we go into the next 20 years or so. So actually, I think the future is very bright for the Lib Dems.
Mike Martin, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
The vexed issue of Eurostar not stopping in Ashford has been rumbling on what seems forever now. Nick, I understand the local MP has spoken out about this week.
Yes, so the Ashford MP, Sojan Joseph, he raised a question in PMQs this week about the importance of the train stopping at Ashford and how important it was to the economic growth of the area, and not just Ashford itself, but also Kent and also the wider southeast. He feels it's vitally important that this service is reintroduced, and he asked Sir Keir Starmer what he thought the government should be doing about it. I mean, the good thing is that Sir Keir actually stood up and said, yep, he totally agreed. He understood the frustrations that people had, that there was this international train station there, it was built, it had all been used, and the fact that, you know, there are now no longer these trains stopping. And he said that he was more than happy for the Rail Minister to update Mr Joseph on the latest issue, but the government absolutely wanted this service to be reinstated to Ashford, although he did accept that it was Eurostar's final decision. So there's not much say-so there. Probably lots of persuasion, but yeah, ultimately we're in Eurostar's hands.
Mm. I think it all boils down to money in the end, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does boil down to money. I mean, we know that the services were stopped because they said it was no longer viable for them to be there at Ashford and also at Ebbsfleet as well. It's not just the MP that's been raising the issue. There's also been a team of Ashford leaders who have got together this week and said, you know, it's nearly 30 years on from the station opening, and they would really like to see that come the 30th anniversary, which is next year, they want to see it back open again. Mm. I mean, they've said, you know, it was an £80 million construction project, and here we are, and it's been mothballed.
That's very, very sad. Well, we've got the election of a new Kent mayor to look forward to next May, possibly, if the government gives it the nod. So naturally, the gossiping about who might put themselves forward and the realistic chances of reform winning. Speaking of reform, Rob, I mean, you know, you've been watching this fairly closely over the last couple of weeks, I understand. What's your sense of reform's chances of winning the mayor?
Well, they certainly, I mean, if media reports are seen to believe, and if Nigel Farage's contributions are to be believed, they definitely have a momentum. And I think from a Kent perspective, and particularly from Medway, we've got three by-elections coming up. How Reform do in those will be a key indicator of how they sit within the county. In each of the three Medway constituencies, Reform placed a close third. And so the Gillingham South and Rochester East by-elections will be very interesting. The Reform have not yet announced their candidates, if they're even going to stand, so we don't know who they may be. But I think if they did stand, a major factor will be how many Labour supporters turn out, or if they stay home. In terms of a Kent mayor, I think the interesting thing about that is lots of the time the thing that is held against reform and smaller parties is they don't have experience running councils or running a government, and that's a major thing that holds them back. With a Kent mayor, no party has been a Kent mayor yet, so reform could easily make the argument, well, we know as much about being a Kent mayor as anybody else does, so why not trust in us? There's a general dissatisfaction with the two main parties. I think of the two, if reform weren't in this, I think the Conservatives are probably the more likely to win the Kent mayoralty. But I think the reform will definitely throw a spanner in the works.
Absolutely. I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I spoke to a couple of Conservatives this week who seemed to think that it was almost bolted on that the Conservatives would win. I just said, well, hang on a second, you know, reform were polling regularly, you know, 25%+ by elections right across the whole piece, and the national polling is very, very good. But having said that, yes, if I was spending 100 quid of your money on a betting shop, I'd probably put it on the Tories winning, but who knows. I have, of course, the usual sort of gossips and rumour mongers have been putting forward some names of potential Conservative candidates and who they might be. Now, four have come to the fore, and I've spoken to all of them. Former KCC, Kent County Council leader, Paul Carter, who's a pretty big beast in Kent politics and has sort of done the job of mayor already. He declined to say anything other than he wouldn't rule himself out, which is usually his way of saying, I'm not telling you this, I'm not saying yes, I'm not saying no, but I'm going to keep everybody guessing. But I suspect he probably would want to throw his hat in the ring. Matthew Scott, who's the Kent Police and Crime Commissioner, he was less coy. He said, I'm definitely going to go for it, no matter what. Mm-hmm. He says that he runs a big organisation, 500 million quid, and the mayor tends to take on the role of the commissioner anyway. And then I talked to the former MP Adam Holloway. He's no longer in Parliament after being booted out in July, and he said that people have suggested to him, but he's had the lurgy and like everyone's had, and he said he hasn't really had a proper chance to think about it and see. But from that point of view, he didn't rule it out. And Lord Craig McKinley, the former Thanet MP, he claims not to have given it much thought, but wouldn't rule out having a look at it either. But I suspect what will happen is that some people will consider their thoughts and their chances. And if Sir Paul Carter does decide to throw his hat into the ring, I think some of them will very gracefully just step aside, because most people seem to think that he would be far greater an adversary than any of the other Conservatives who might put themselves forward. That's only what I'm hearing. I'm just letting you know. Okay, folks, that's it for this week. Thanks to Rob, Dan and Nikki, and our special guest Mike Martin. Good to have your company for the first time this year. Don't forget you can keep an eye on kentonline.com/politics for the latest news from across the county, and you can also sign up to our politics briefing newsletter by visiting kentonline.co.uk/newsletters, and don't miss KMTV's politics show every Friday at 5 p.m. Okay, see you next time. Thank you, bye bye.
Thanks for listening to the Kent Politics Podcast. Don't forget to check out stories throughout the week on the politics page of Kent Online. And you can watch the Kent Politics Show with Rob Bailey on KMTV every Friday at 5 p.m. or on demand at kmtv.co.uk.
This has been an I Am Listening original podcast. For more information, head over to our website, iam-listening.co.uk.